can take it off.
Okay. Okay.
It's already unloaded.
Thank you.
So, good morning, everybody. Can we settle down, please? Good morning. So I'm going to hide behind this pillar that both sides can see me nicely. For the ones who don't know me, I'm Eberhard Lisse. I'm the chair of the technical working group. And I have omitted with a forethought the word CCNSO in this regard. Welcome again to our usual Tech Day. Today, I think we have a number of really cool presentations. The first one will be Dmitry Kochmanyuk from the Ukraine, and who will show us how you set up DNSSEC in 6 months in a reasonably sized registry. Then we'll have a really cool presentation, a short one, one that is a little bit shorter though than expected because it was put together on very short notice. Richard Lamp will talk about TPM, which I call the poor man's HMS, but it's rather a trusted something platform management chip, which can be twisted into using hardware signing things. Then Thorsten Kraft from ECHO or D6 will talk a little bit about tap packet inspections, what you can do with this, what you can't do or what you shouldn't do, and what you should be afraid of. And then we'll have lunch. Lunch has been sponsored by the Dutch Registry. We hope that we'll get somebody to say a few words, or at least we usually offer them a few words. It will be a boxed lunch, but only people who are here at 12:50 will get something. So don't run away too early. In the afternoon, we will have the usual host presentation, but even better this time because Andre is going to do it. And then we will have a roundtable about four DNS servers. As we all know, there is, as far as authoritative name servers are, there is bind 9 and coming to be 10 and NSD. And then there is the new two kids on the block, Yadifa from Eurid and not DNS from the Czech, Nick. So I think this is going to be quite interesting to compare notes. And as Olaf Kolkman used to say, we're all among friends here. This is not going to be a slugfest that we try to pick each other apart. But it's good to compare. It's good to see what things can do and why one should try and take a different one. And then, as usual, this time it's Norm Ritchie who's going to... twisted into making the closing speech. All right. Without further ado, Dmitry. Just one more thing. We have a remote presentation, which means if a question comes from remote, I think they will get precedence. And we have got two room microphones for a discussion afterwards. And you can remain seated if it's easier for you.
Thanks, everyone. Well, this is probably more interested to CCTLD operators, especially small ones. I don't have to say why DNSSEC is important, but if I can move this forward, then okay. So the original plan was about a year ago, and I was deliberating it for a very long time. The kickoff point was November 8th, 2011, during one of our IPv6 technology workshops in Ukraine. We held those about quarterly. Well, it's kind of a revolutionary day in Soviet history, if somebody knows what I mean. We started to deploy in a subzone called UA.UA, just a test zone. Some interesting experiences were gained. The key was generated on November 8th, as I said, and the zone was signed. The UA zone had a secure delegation. I also set up a very small website, which had just a page saying it works and an anchor. So I think it's very important to start doing this with something that you don't mind breaking and experiment all the way, because you would not get the chance doing this later on the production zone. So as I said, it's 6 months. It actually was a little less than that. So let's see. Well, the DNSSEC trigger was instrumental to verify how things work. All the various options were tried, including N63 and N63 with opt-out. Also had wildcard record in that zone, something you don't normally do in production. But it was very interesting to see various interactions, especially with unbound and bind, not handling N63 with wildcard in some corner cases. So about a month later, we had the official UA KSK generation ceremony. It was scripted and rehearsed. The event was dedicated to the 19th anniversary of UA domain operation. It was recorded and published on a website. We had about 10 people participating as observers on stage. About 60 people attended the event. Having a small website, I mean a web page, a mini blog in our case, was very helpful. I list the parameters we have used. Nothing so special here. I also want to add that we ended up using N63 with opt-out. So in parallel, I was setting up the test environment. So essentially a full replica of the current UA production, but using separate hardware. I list some details here. Bind 9.8 was then current release. Now, of course, I would use 9.9. We'll probably migrate to this at some point. Lots of internal scripting. We had an hourly cron job generating the zone and signing it. So it was completely parallel setup. And as I said, several sleepless nights. Lots of fun. Again, it's very good to test things which you don't mind breaking, because they were breaking a few times. So we also had a separate Anycast server with complete replica of the zone, all the records the same, separate anchor, and you were able to use it if you just use type forward zone or maybe just local unbound. Again, DNSSEC trigger is probably the way to use it. Just set it up on your own laptop and try. Lots of people use this. We use this in our company internally. So next step was to offer the public resolver, which was using that test zone as a UA zone. The project was codenamed Lighthouse. It was announced at another workshop on February 7th, so it was, 3 months in. It was using that authoritative server I have mentioned. So essentially, if you use this as your resolver, that was easier than, you know, doing any magic. It just works, and you were able to install Firefox or Chrome plugin developed in Prague, thanks to Zinnik, and it was another tool I would never be as successful, and, well, that was another testing point. Well, next was, I should have mentioned this. I was in a CAN meeting in Costa Rica, and Steve Crook and I had a little chat during the dinner. He was asking me how things are working, and I was saying that I'm about to do this, but I'm not sure exactly when. And then he just asked me to draw a little plan on a napkin, and that was actually like the point of no return. So I just went ahead with everything, and we were live on Friday, April 13th. Since then, we had 6 secure delegations, 2 of registrars, and 2 geographical domains, 3 domains. Every one of those I walk us through. Again, it helps to have those test bed setups because half of those were already present in the test zone. So we knew then we go live, it'll be working already. So there was no this, what about we turn this on and somebody else breaks? I think that's all. Oh, no, that's the traffic. So it's been slowly growing up. I think it's about, I'll put this number there. It's about 0.2% of the overall DNS traffic. So the queue rate now is about, I would say, 4 average, 6 max per second. As again, that's only one of our servers. So we have 6 servers in UA, so that's the one we run. Not so much, you know, but with the number of delegations we have, it's not surprising. I guess I'll stop now, and that's the status page we had. And any questions from the audience, please? Thank you.
I didn't get, how are you signing hardware?
No, it's all software, just bind 9.8 script only, nothing fancy really. I would not have a budget for that, nor the time to debug.
Hi, Dmitry. Right, Aaron Schnamenet.
I should also add, the zone is quite small. We had about 15,000 delegations in it, so the performance is not a problem. The whole signing process takes like 5 seconds.
Okay, I've a different question than independent of DNSSEC. You mentioned you started with a testbed, UA.UA.
Yeah.
Now, in Holland, we did something similar about 10, 12 years ago.
Yes.
Where we had NL.NL.
I know, that's why.
Yes. But what we saw almost immediately, or basically what we noticed, what people told us almost immediately, is that some resolvers, some OSs have configured NL as a search path, and that broke things horribly. Did you see this the same?
I know what you mean. I actually set up UA.UA about 10 years ago exactly because of your experiences, and we have been running this, and I was monitoring query rate. This, I call it the double TLD anomaly. I should probably write a small report. We do have query logs. Thankfully, the amount of those V requests is steadily falling down. So when I was trying this, I was pretty confident I'm not going to break anything. And my UA zone was not a real zone. It was just a zone with a wildcard record reset. This is UA, this is DNSSEC. So I probably broke it for very small people who had A, those V resolver behavior, and B, DNSSEC enabled. I think the intersection of those sets is empty.
Good.
But I, of course, can't attest to that. Yeah, but thank you for this point. Yeah, it's very interesting. As I said, this zone is just a test bone. And we had this reserved since like 2002.
Okay. I've been asked by Dr. Eberhard to make this point again. So
that's why we had it reserved, because we decided to never delegate this domain.
I understand. I'm just trying to elaborate on it a little bit. So there is something called a search path in your etcresolve.conf. And the reserve... So the search part could have something like nominate.org.uk, or it could have something like NL. So when you type in the domain name, and it might be suffixed with NL. So sometimes you had something.nl.nl, and of course that wouldn't resolve properly.
Okay, any other questions? Come on, don't let him off so easy.
Okay, good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Do you want to go now? Okay. Next one will be Richard Lamb. You can just put it down. Okay, for the remote participants, Richard was kindly enough to just put this presentation together on extremely short notice. I met him yesterday evening in the pub about it, because on that Fred Masterclass we had the day before with CZNIC, where we met Jaromir, the programmer of and his team. And Luis from .cr mentioned that they're using a TPM chip, and he mentioned Richard's name about it. So I think it's actually quite a cool thing to look at it.
All right, thank you. Thank you very much. I'd rather, you know, stay standing so I don't, you know, fall asleep. I apologize for the roughness of this presentation here. This was a last minute thing, but it is something I'm very excited about. And with the help with Luis in Costa Rica, you know, he's the one that kind of started started the germ of the idea going as far as using a TPM chip. So the poor man's HSN. And thanks to Eberhard. I mean, I didn't realize the poor man made spelled out TPM. So this is perfect. I'm slow. English is not my first language. You know, I went to public school system. So one of the things in deploying DNSSEC, okay, is everyone goes, well, you know, do we use soft keys, hardware keys, you know, or what have you? Do we use smart cards? Do we spend $20,000 for, you know, a high-end cryptographic device or what? For most of us, we don't have $20,000 burning a hole in our pockets, but we still would like security. You know, we still would like a system that actually ensures that the private half of the keys that we use for DNSSEC is protected in some way. Well, it turns out that Dell computers, Dell servers, I think Gateway servers, IBM servers, a whole bunch of machines out there, commodity hardware, has this cryptographic chip built in it. And no one really uses it. You know, it was originally put in place there for the purposes of being able to attest to the integrity of the hardware on a PC, and then also to attest to be able to, you know, check the digital signature on various pieces of software and stuff. And as some of you may remember, the TPM wars, maybe about, you know, 5-6 years ago, there everyone was really angry. Says this is an evil plot by Wintel. You know, hopefully, there's no one in here from Intel or Microsoft, but you know, Microsoft and Intel to somehow lock down, DRM, digital rights management, lock down, you know, software and stuff like that. Anyway, for whatever reason, maybe some of that politics, you know, some of the other things, the TPM chip kind of is not used. But in any case, Luis identified, there's this TPM chip there, and there's been software out there trying to use the TPM chip for various other things for a while, and at least every time I've tried it, I've failed. You know, the software is not quite up to snuff. But now there's added incentive and enough motivation to actually, you know, do go that extra last mile and figure out how to make this you know, open source software that actually works with the TPM chip work. And so that's what I'm going to talk about really quickly here. PKCS11 is an interface to HSMs. It's a standardized API for HSMs. It doesn't matter whether it's a smart card or whether it's a $20,000 HSM or whatever it is. And so this is a good thing. You know, if we can write to this, it's a good thing. A number of some of the recent versions of Bind have support for it. They work through the OpenSSL engine in order to be able to make this stuff work. And there are various ways to do this. I wrote something. I modified DNSSEC sign zone a long, long time ago to just directly talk PKCS11. You know, who needs OpenSSL? So I just went straight to this. And so, you know, from my point of view, it's kind of easy. But it's good to have the standard. And for, you know, the PKCS11 interface has a million different things. Delete object, wrap object, you know, ways to export keys, import keys, backup things, all kinds of stuff. But all we really need is two functions. In DNSSEC, all we really ever do is generate a pair of keys, RSA keys, what have you, and we sign with those keys. So, you know, if you actually get into this stuff, you'll find the PKCS11 interface is not that, you know, vendors have slightly different variations of this everywhere. But all we really need is these two things to work. That's it. Okay? So there's various open source software. I know these are very sparse slides. I was just throwing this stuff together. There's not much here. But the smart card, you know, that we all have, and I actually go around doing a training course for ICANN where I say, you know, for some of these smaller TLDs, all you really need is a DVD with some software on it and a smart card reader, a flash drive, and a smart card to do this. Only does one signature per second, but that's actually, if you're just looking at the KSK, for example, not the KSK and the ZSK, just the KSK, how often do you change that? How often do you really use that? Not that often. So one signature per second actually works. And these things are certified to all kinds of levels. You can get a pretty highly secure smart card, actually. Again, the idea here is don't let the private key ever out. That's it. You're really just protecting the private key. And these things are great at doing this. In fact, most smart cards, you can put something on here, but you can never take it out. Once you've written the private key in here, there's no way to extract it. So the open source software that supports smart cards is OpenSE. It's been around for a while. It's actually improved vastly in the last year. I mean, before that, it was just you just couldn't count on it. Sometime it would work, sometime it wouldn't work. Now it works on Macs. It works on all the Linux flavors. It's actually pretty good. It supports a wide range of cards. So this is pretty cool. But it's one signature per second, and when you try to go buy a smart card, if I'm getting too long, let me know. But if you try to buy a smart card, these things are not sold in quantity one. Okay, these are things that are sold to large defense departments or agencies, you know, in quantity 20,000 or a million. So it's kind of hard to get these things, and then sometimes you run into some export regulations, which is kind of silly. So let's look at this trusted platform module chip, this chip that's actually already inside the PCs. Well, it turns out there's an open source package that supports the TPM. It's called open CryptoKey, I think I'm pronouncing that right, and trousers. And, you know, if you have Ubuntu or something like that, you can just, I think you just go, apt-get, install this, and it actually kind of works. It's still somewhat disappointingly slow, but still, this is something that is in devices and you could use right away, and it's built into servers, a lot of servers, and it actually allows you to, because of the way this works, it allows you to actually have any number of, any number of keys. Actually, it's not just one key. You can actually use the TPM chip to manage many keys, because actually the TPM chip only, it's about this small. It only holds the master key that encrypts everything else. So you generate keys on it. It has a random number generator on it, which is very, very critical. One of the biggest problems that people have found out there with SSL, and there have been recent studies on this, is that the source of the key, the random number generators, are bad. They're using a bad source of random numbers. And so one of the most, if you use nothing else about the TPM except for the random number generator, you're ahead. Okay? Because the random number generators on these sort of things are very well thought out and certified, and that people have spent their lives trying to do this right. So that's pretty good. So that's that. So, all right. So this is where the talk is going to go a little strange here. I'm going to go through this slide deck, and I'm going to describe what Luis and I did in for CRNIC after that. But so the one signature per second for the TPM chip that I'm getting there was a little bit disturbing to me, and I said, "Well, this is kind of ridiculous. That's kind of slow. Why can't I get something faster?" In fact, if you look at the data sheet for the TPM chip, let's see if I can scroll down here. This is a standard TPM chip that you will find in many machines, and I don't know if I can. Let's see. Do I have something? Yeah, I got something evil in my pocket here. All right, so. So you can actually see on here that it'll do a 1024-bit RSA signature in 40 milliseconds. I think that's about 25 or something signatures per second. Not one, 25. I mean, so this thing actually should be able to do pretty good. It'll do looks like 200 milliseconds for a 2048-bit. So. This kind of this made me wonder, and you can pull the hook out at any time if I'm going on too long, but so it made me wonder and kind of excited about what we could do here. So I looked at the chipset, 25 per second generates the TPMs inside, has a random number generated. This is everything I need. Private keys are always encrypted, infinite number of keys, And there's actually a mechanism. One of the things that you got to look at when you decide what you're going to use to generate your keys, if it's a hardware device, is how do I back up the keys? So here we are doing everything we can to protect the private half of the key. And if it's inside a device that I can never take out, never get anything out of, how do I back up the keys? Something can fail. I mean, if it fails, I'm dead. Well, it turns out this well-defined TPM and the standards that go along with it, they have something that allows you to do this. So I put this up here just in case, you do get the slides at some point, and this stuff really does interest you like it interests me, you Google that, and you will probably then pull in all the cruft and all the documents you need to be able to make this happen. So anyway, I said to myself, gee, okay, I want to get 25 signatures per second. Why don't I just build it? I don't care. This is not as ICANN. Let's just solve the problem. Here's the missing. There are HSMs that work at one signature per second. There are HSMs that work at 1,000 signatures per second at $20,000. Nothing's stopping me from today. I can do anything I want. So I laid out the board. I built a surface mount solder oven. Okay, this is just a toaster oven with a PID controller, which you just stick in series with a solid state relay and. And this is my kitchen anyway. so, and this works really cool. This is Well, I won't say that word, but, you know, if you're a geek, you really get excited. So, you know, and so I put the board in there and, you know, put it at the surface mount. This is tiny, tiny work, right? Surface mount. I put the parts on there, and lo and behold, you know, that's what comes out. In fact, here it is. So, I'll pass it around if I get it back. All right, so I better get this back because otherwise I'll kill you. This is not ICANN. This is my stuff, you know. So anyway, just pass it around. Anyway, so here's the TPM chip. Okay, $2.50. Here's something that talks USB to the rest of the world, right? I mean, because you need it. USB is the interface everyone wants. This is what I keep hearing from people. We don't have to want to use Ethernet. We just want a USB thing. We should look like a fob. So that's all. This is a generic 8-bit processor. And here's some flash. There's 8 megabytes of flash, just in case I want to put the keys on here. One of the problems with the HSMs out there, even the expensive ones, is they keep all that HSM material, key material, on your hard drive. So now you need to make sure that the files are synchronized with the HSM. And even at the root, this is something that is very hard to do when we do this, because we need to make sure those files are exactly the same, because if they're not in sync, you got nothing. You got garbage. Okay? So put it there. There's a crystal, 8 megahertz crystal. And I threw this on there, too, because this is a really high-precision real-time clock. It's not a cesium clock. It's not rubidium. It's not atomic, but it's really high precision. Some of the things I'd heard from some of the experts in this DNSSEC community was, you know, there are other things we'd want. We want a perfect sense of time, one that's not coming from someplace else, not something we count on, something that might even limit the signature validity period for RSIGs. If you look carefully at, you know, DNSSEC, I mean, there are some, and HSM will sign anything. So if someone gets a hold of, you know, compromises your system, and they get into your system and they say, okay, you know, I want you to sign, give me a RSIG valid for this bogus set of, you know, bogus information for the next 20 years. HSM will do it. They don't care. So anyway, so I built this thing. There you go. And I wrote all the code. I mean, it's very hard to probably see this from back there, but you know, this is the code that sits embedded on the chip, on the 8-bit chip. And here, gosh, this is going to be hard to see, but I'll try to describe some of this. This is just running DNSSEC sign zone. So I run DNSSEC sign zone with the, you know, -V flag to make it just be really voluminous. So you'll see it's signing with, you know, DNS key up here. Here it's signing, I think, an NS record, an MX record, you know, DNS key. It's actually retained because I used another KSK to do that. Anyway, this is just proof that, you know, this little thingy that any one of you could build, okay? Nothing should stop you, right? There's no barriers here. You know, actually works with DNSSEC sign zone and creates a valid sign zone. So anyway, that, you know, that's the fun part of it. Fun part of this talk. I think I'll, you know, if I may, okay. If I may, I will now try to describe a little bit of either verbally or with something on here, what we did in for CRNIC. Let's see, CRNIC, come on. Part two. I can play. I apologize for this. Here we go. Let's see this one. I am repurposing slides here. I apologize. Okay. I apologize for that right off the bat. Let's see. Blah, 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 blah. Garbage, come on. Where is it? Garbage. Well, I mean, these are some of the pictures I show all the time. I mean, you know, this is how some people store their stuff, which is perfectly valid. You know, you don't need a fancy setup to do secure deployment. Okay, here we go. Oh, there we go. I think that's it. All right, so let's see. Okay. Well, all right. Well, this is. So, I mean, so once you have this TPM system in place, I mean, so here's one approach. This is not, you know, this was not the CRNIC slide that I was actually looking for. Well, let me see if I can look for that. I apologize. This just might be better if I do this right here. Here we go. This should do it. Oh, God. This is... things never work when they're supposed to work, do they? Okay. Well, I'm just going to. I think I'm just going to talk through this then. All right. So once you get the TPM system working, there are a couple things you could do. You could use the TPM chip to both generate your KSKs and your ZSKs, and for .cr, Luis decided in the sense of coming up with the most secure system to actually secure both the ZSKs and the KSKs this way. And you can do that. Okay, so even if the signatures per second is not the fastest thing in the world, you can actually use this to secure both your ZSKs and KSKs. And the way that you would then do the key management in that case is you would generate, so that you're never transferring private keys in the clear, you would actually generate the ZSKs on your signer, your regular signer that signs your zone a couple times a day. And then all you need to transfer across is just the public half of those ZSKs on a flash drive, sneaker net, to your secure facility. And at your secure facility, then you could actually just with the public, you just transfer the public part of the ZSKs. Then you could use the ZSK, which is generated and maintained with the TPM on a offline laptop, and sign everything there, generate your signed DNS key RR sets. This is exactly what we do at the root, and this is what a lot of people do. You pre-generate these DNS key RR sets, and that way you never have to put the KSK online. And then you get these set of DNS keys that you've now created, signed with the KSK, put them on a flash drive, take them back to your signer, and just append them to your zone file that you want to sign with the ZSK, and away you go. And so that was the approach used there. It's been working very well as far as I could tell, and it's a perfectly valid approach. I've been approached by other people that have said, we wanted to use the TPM stuff as well, and I think at some point we would like to be able to publish all the details of this, and I think I don't know, I'm going to look at Luis, but at some point I think we will publish all that, and so that everyone can learn from that experience and try to improve upon it, because I built this board and all that, but if the TPM chip is in fact on most of these motherboards, we should be able to use this more effectively. We should be able to get that full performance out of it. That's the goal. We would love to be able to get 25 signatures per second, and also be able to take advantage of some of the import-export migration tools used to be able to back up the keys between TPMs. And in fact, just as an aside, the way that works is there's nothing magical. So every TPM chip generates a master key inside of it. It's called the SRK. And so if you have two TPM chips or two machines with TPMs on it, they both have their own unique public-private keys in them that no one sees, never leaves the thing, okay? But you can read the public key. So what you do is you actually take the public key of the TPM chip that you want to transfer the data to, and you actually then submit that via a special TPM function call to the TPM that has the keys, and you say to that, please allow me to use this key to migrate. And so you do that, it spits back a specially encoded little blob, and now you can use that blob to transfer anything. So this is something we might want to do in the future, right? In this future. Transfer any blob from any encrypted blob from that set into the other. So you're encrypting with the public key, of which the other TPM only knows the private key, is the only thing that knows the private key. So you're safe. So once you've encrypted that with the public key of this other TPM, only that other TPM can read that data, and only internally, and only inside the TPM. So security is maintained. So pretty common sense tools that are in place. It all kind of makes sense, and because it's hardware, it just kind of works. So that's all I have to say. It's sorry for it being a little bit disjointed, but I thought the idea, it is possible to use some hardware that's actually out there already, and if you're really aggressive about it, build your own. So anyway, with that, I think I'm done. Any questions?
Thank you very much. That was very cool, Warren.
So, Rick, yeah. Do you have any extra boards left over? Just the PC board?
I mean, you had 10 of them when you No, the answer is, do you have a microwave oven?
No, that wasn't a microwave oven. That'd blow everything up. I made three of the board. They come in blocks of three, and I solder them myself. I'm looking at trying to figure out a way to do this in a more, you know, mass production way, so that, you know, I could at least generate some to hand out to some good friends. I mean, the parts are pretty expensive, right? The TPM's a couple dollars. The 8-bit MPU is like $10. You know, so the whole board, and the board's three for $100, you know, or something like that. But that's really small prototype quantity. So I'd be interested in making a few more of these things, because I think it's fertile ground to people to experiment with. This is all just C, you know, GCC AVR. I don't know. It's all just, this is all open source tools. It's C programming. It's unlike the pure software world, you know, things actually do what they say they're supposed to do. So, you know, anyway.
It's very nice talk. It's a very good experiment. Yeah. But this is really, you approach this poor man. But I want to say that also for rich men, there is also special clusters produced by Intel specifically for computer clusters and for cloud, mm-hmm. that have specific environment to do this kind remote secure environment that you can do certified and actually encrypt and store all information securely at a remote environment. So if you want to run the really very powerful, you have already solution, but surely not for poor men.
Yes.
So just embedded on there.
It's all embedded in that. That's the whole point.
Hi, Rick. Thank you for that. Now, I'm no hardware expert by any means, but it's clear that we have a gap somewhere between your $100 board and somewhere between the ridiculous amount of money we pay for like Sun SCA 6000.
Right.
So how much work does it take for you to take your board and put a Nitrox 3 processor from Cavium onto it so that we can then get 200,000 SIGs per second off it?
Not that much. I probably don't even need that processor to get it to be up to that speed. A lot of it is a question of certification. So I don't know if you guys are familiar with the certifications that follow HSMs, but pretty much people follow the U.S. set of certifications, the FIPS 140 standards, just because there's a lack of anything else, not because, you know, the U.S. has any particular say here. The reason I went this way, Jay, was because the TPM chip itself already has a certain level of certification associated with it, and in my, you know, kind of heart of hearts, I'm dreaming that, you know, I might actually go for one of those certifications for this thing, you know. Warren laughs, but anything is possible, okay? And there really are no barriers here, right? So in my mind, and so I think it's about $15,000 to get the basic certification. So the hope was that, you know, I could maybe do this with this. I think the problem with going with something else much faster, it's not a software problem, it's not a hardware problem. It's now I'm going to have to really certify the whole, go through a much longer process in getting the thing certified and more, I think, more of a six-digit cost to get something certified. That is not impossible either. I mean, I think there are actually plenty of organizations, even in the U.S., that would be happy to fund this sort of thing, this sort of effort, just to improve DNSSEC and security and, you know, general good. So I'd be interested in doing that. But that's the reason. That's why I went this route. That's why I went the slow route. I didn't go for that because I thought, you know, what's the point of that? I'm never going to be able to get that out of my pocket.
Rick, did you notice Han Zhang from Korea is in the room?
Oh, he is. Okay.
They can make it smaller.
Because what I would encourage you to go with that, because I think that's the one thing that's missing, is somebody who's willing to take a lead on doing this.
Yeah.
And I'd be very interested in contributing to that, and I imagine many others would be. I don't know how much any of us actually desperately need the certification if we're part of the, you know, the process by which it's created. What we need is reliable, cheap hardware that doesn't have anything to do with Oracle or any other idiot manufacturer involved in it, that we can trust, that does the things we need it to do. And I think many of us are willing to put money in to do that. We just need somebody who's got the talent to lead that, please.
No, I'm wondering, is this not something that you can put on a little laptop? Netbook?
Yeah.
Inexpensive, run Ubuntu, get it all sorted, and use that thing.
Chain
it to the wall, put it in a safe. Why does one really have to build a little...
You don't.
Can't.
You don't see that. I mean, that's the it's a fuzzy wall. I mean, at some point, it is just a cheap laptop that you leave offline and have the proper procedures and practices to protect. That's just as good, and that's going to do well. But I think what Jay was saying, he needs something online that's fast. I mean, as soon as you take that laptop and put it online, forget it. It's no longer something that, it may be secure, but it's harder to prove that. DNSSEC has a certain amount of theater associated with it, okay? admittedly. And so there needs to be some way to provide comfort for not the engineers in this room. I mean, I know I'm preaching to the choir with you. I mean, you know this, right? It's not just comfort to people in this room, but comfort to people that don't really know this stuff, the financial community. And this is why those weird little standards kind of matter to me. It's not, you know... I think in order to get the credibility from that wider audience that we need to... Well, maybe you know, someone has a better answer. I love the answer to be no to that, but I've got that sense that you know... Well, for ICANN, we need to get things certified. We need to get things audited through a SysTrust audit done by PwC, all right? One of and it's very clear. It's got to be an HSM, you know, FIPS level 4, level 3, something like that. They're very clear rules where I have no option. That being said, of course, you know, I agree with you. I mean, from a security perspective, a laptop that's been carefully brought into the system and checked out, generating the keys is just as good, if not better. No. than some stupid little 8-bit processor, you know.
So. No, I'm looking at it from an entry perspective. Dimitri just mentioned that's how they did. We do it exactly the same way. We also do soft signing. But for a small little zone like that, to start this, one of the big barriers to using hardware is the price.
Yeah.
If you take a little netbook that costs about $200 and you make a nice little welded cage in your office that has a very big lock on it, so that that thing has two locks that only two people at the same time can access.
Okay,
it. Things like this that should really be for an entry level operation 15,000 names that should do it from the beginning.
It's all about satisfying your relying party. I mean, the people that are using your system. If you can get their trust, you're done. So you know. Two locks that you don't have the key to both for, I think is perfectly reasonable. Yes.
I'd like to congratulate you. That was one of the most interesting and entertaining technical presentations I've been to at Tech Day.
That's
more
sad.
Impressive, since as you seem to have done it between pub and breakfast.
Yeah. Wow.
What I was going to say was just a little comment in passing when you were picking up what you said about theatre.
Yeah.
What you're actually saying is it works better if you put it in a steel box that's an inch thick. I mean.
I mean,
it's part of life, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, that's partially true. I mean, if you actually look, I mean. I think you know this as well. I mean, if you look at the standards and certifications, there is some logic behind them. It is not just theater. And it does provide, I mean, we live in a legal environment. It does provide credibility that engineers would not otherwise be able to easily garner. I don't know if I'm getting that message out correctly. I mean, we could have the smartest guys in the room and this is a different community, the financial community. It's a different set of people. And in order for that trust to jump across that barrier, we need, unfortunately...
Steel boxes.
Steel boxes, okay. Well, all right.
Thank
fine.
You very much.
All right.
Just a quick comment. Thanks, Rick, for excellent presentation. I mean, I'll buy one of those. It'll be available. Can you just, I mean, forget the certification. Can you just Kickstarter the thing and make a set of 1,000? I mean, people would pay you, you know, the Kickstarter. I mean, that's, I think you're in California, you know what to do. You'll be rich in next year, you know. Seriously, I mean, and don't worry about certification. Somebody else would do the certification for you.
Let me first see how I can, you know, can get a larger number of these things produced and be able to, you know, get some experimentation going. Because you're right. I mean, at some point you go to all this work and you say, well, what have I just built here? I've just built another PC. Well, why don't I just use a PC? I mean, you know. And so, but my purpose in doing this was to try to grasp at that higher performance that those chips could actually provide. And for some reason, are not being able to, because of the way the operating system's laid out or the way drivers are laid out. I don't know what it is, but there's something stopping you from getting that full performance. And those TPM chips continue to improve. Every year, they produce another one that's faster and faster. At some point, we might hit the 100 signature per second kind of barrier, and that would be. Then it becomes useful, right?
My dad used to be a radio amateur.
Yeah,
which means I'm quite sure there are a lot of people in the Ukraine who will solder this together for you if you get the plans. I think the technical once you figure this out, but you will publish the plan, I'm sure.
I'll publish this circuit diagram.
Sorry. Let him finish. Yeah. This is basically open source altogether. So you can publish the plans.
There's nothing special here. Yeah.
So then you get one of your guys. Here's the stuff. Put it in the microwave oven, and it will work. But
not the microwave.
But I personally
toaster oven.
Yeah, I know. I actually prefer the idea of a little netbook.
Okay.
Because it's one thing. You can put a name on it. You can put it in. It's you can lock it up. You can even paint it in a way that you know that's the one that must be there and nobody must touch it and things like this.
I agree with you.
That this dongle gets lost and things. I actually like the big thing about the laptop, it has got software on it. I just need to put a button. I don't need to think. I run a program and it's done. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as long as you make sure that this thing remains offline, we could even disable Ethernet. We could even physically disable the Ethernet adapter. We could even physically disable the radio in there and the Bluetooth, so that it's actually not possible to connect this thing physically to
We do that at the root. We have a laptop that is a special laptop that we pay a lot extra for that has no Wi-Fi, has no hard drive. It is. and we yank the battery out and throw it away because batteries can go bad if they're sitting in a closed environment for a long time.
Yeah.
No argument.
Yeah. The triple EPC costs $200. Simple.
No argument.
Okay. All right. Any other questions?
And I would like that board back at some point.
Rick, so would everybody in this room. my board. All right. I think this was very cool. As Nigel said, one of the... most fascinating presentations I've heard in a long while, in particular since you were so kind of slapping it together on short notice. In the meantime, Thorsten Kraft will set up. Thorsten Kraft works at D6. I happened to fly together with his boss in the same plane to Costa Rica, and they mentioned that Focke Rotor, ne? Michael Rother is the chair of ECHO, the association of the internet industry in Germany. And he mentioned on the plane that they also do an internet exchange and they look at packet inspection to prevent botnets and so on. And in my country, they want to try and pass a law that not only forces the telecoms to listen to us, they want to our presentations, our telephones, our communications with the doctors and the lawyers, but they also want them to save this data preemptively and retrospectively make it available and things like this. And I got worried. So I asked whether they couldn't come around and tell us what they're doing, what one can do, what one should do, and what's possible and what we should be afraid of. I'm not sure whether this is exactly the gist of your presentation, but I hope you can delve into these issues at least at the end of it.
Hello, everybody. My name is Thorsten Kraft. I'm from ECO, the Association of the German Internet Industry, and one of our subsidiaries is DKIX, the German exchange point in Frankfurt. And what you see here at the walls is the daily traffic we manage in Frankfurt. So in a peak time, we have, I think, around 2 terabit of data packages in a second. Quite a lot to do a lot of bad stuff like the packet inspection or something like that to prevent botnet. But what we are doing in Germany is a little bit of different. I want to held a presentation on the German Anti-Botnet Advisory Center to give you a short overview of what we have done and set up here in this place. And I want to give you the possibility to listen very close to it. Afterwards, I want to have a question into the room, what you have missed in there, and then I want to start a discussion with you. Okay, the German Anti-Botnet Advisory Center, why has it been set up here in Germany? Because millions of computers worldwide are infected with a piece of malware, unnotified, unnoticed by the computer owners, and Germany was in the top 10 rank, and the German government wanted to change this, and because they are not happy about this position in a worldwide ranking. So the goals of the Anti-Botnet Advisory Center was to support the end customers in the subject of internet security, to reduce the botnet behaviors, to free the infected machines from malicious software, and to get Germany out of the top 10 ranking. So what we are doing is helping the customers by removing the malicious software, and we are working together with the internet service providers and antivirus vendors. The target group we have defined were the Microsoft computers, because Microsoft is the major botnet holder, so we are focused on that. ISPs and banks detect by themselves the infected machines and notify their customers and point them to a centralized call center, including a ticket system, and be careful, without personal data. So we only have a ticket ID to not have the possibility to refer back to the end customer. We get initial funding from the German government of 2 million euro. That's a lot of money. And we had to deal with the BSI, the German Ministry of Internet Security. And all the ISPs have to take the necessary technical and organizational steps to implement the initiative to inform customers and to detect infected machines. So, the website has been set up in three steps. We have an inform section, a clean section, and a prevent section. To inform about what we are doing exactly, because we have to be very, very open in how have we detected a malicious or the infected machine. It's a tool to disinfect the machines, and the prevent section, how a customer is able to work or to not get infected 5 minutes later after we have cleaned it up. So in the prevent section, we say check your computers on a regular basis, install service packs and security updates, and run antivirus scanners on a regular basis. These are the ISPs that have been participated: Deutsche Telekom, Vodafone, 1&1, Web.de, and some others. And we have some banks involved there. What you now see is the number of downloads we have received in the time of the Anti-Botnet Advisory has run more than 1.4 million downloads and activation of the tool, and the deletion has been started. The web access
more than 2.5 million visitors, 4.5 million visitors on a blog with additional information on step-by-step advisories, and we have a forum with more than 30,000 support requests. But we now see two different stuff, two different antivirus or virus problems. On the one hand side, a BKA Trojan. That's ransomware that is known as a police Trojan and a DNS changer. You should be, you have heard in the news. And therefore, we have installed different landing pages or two different landing pages to point the customers on that. They see the systems we have scanned for instances in March. And what you see is that a lot of people have multiple infections, more than 8.5 infected files on the system on an average. What we would like now to set up is ACDC, that's the Advanced Cyber Defense Center, with 28 partners in 14 member states. And how it works is the detection has been in this solution as well. So on the one hand side, we are trying to deal with stolen credentials, with drive-by exploits and malware on hosted machines, with spam campaigns, and with DDoS traffic detection. We point all those data to a centralized clearinghouse, trying to analyze the data and pulling out the data to the relevant stakeholders, the hosting companies, the access provider, the mobile network, and to let the customer do cleaning up his PC over the national landing pages. So what you here see is the collecting part. We are using honeypot systems and drone reports, various sensors, and user reports, pointing it to the centralized clearinghouse, working with different entities on the same data feed, pulling out the data to the stakeholders like police, ISPs, universities, and security vendors, and we would like to have value-added services like on the protection side, on the detection side, in the advisory side, and the mitigation stuff. And this is what we have done in Germany here. Again, the ISP is notifying his customer and pointing him to the national platform. So this is how we have done in Germany in the Anti-Botnet Advisory Center. What you have might have mentioned is that there is no deep packet inspection in place. Why is that? Do you have any ideas why we are not using deep packet inspection? We have with DKIX a very big data source where we can find out infected machines. That's possible. The ISPs can do it by themselves, but why don't we do that? Privacy. Pardon?
Privacy.
Privacy. It's forbidden. In Germany, it's forbidden to take a look into the data packages because I'm able to look in each package. I can look into each communication between one and the other. For instance, if credit card credentials are transferred from my PC to a shop and it is not SSL encrypted, then I see private data, the credit card credentials, the passphrases. Any other idea why we are not dealing with the packet inspection to fight botnet?
Is the encrypted data?
Fun?
Encrypted data? Botnets Are the botnets using encryption to counter the deep packet inspection?
Pardon?
Are the botnets using encryption to counter the deep packets?
Yeah. Any other ideas?
Just too much CPU needed.
It costs a lot of resources to look into each packet. How many CPUs do I need to look into each package and to decide what is evil and what is not evil? How many traffic do I have to throw away?
Maybe because of you don't want to, from a moral perspective?
From a law perspective?
No, a moral perspective.
Moral, yes.
Yeah, you just don't want to.
Additionally, yes, that's possible. But that's a very, very hard point. The community is not wanting it. If we are, as a German ISP, are talking about the packet inspection, there's a very, very big cry in the community. What? You are looking into my packages? I cancel the contracts. So I need to have what I have mentioned again, contract. I need to have the permission of my customer to do so. And this is such a hard stuff I will place there that I have to put it very in red letter, very, very big written on there. Be careful, I'm looking for fighting botnet into each package in blah, blah, blah. I need to be transparent in the contract. Any other ideas why I don't use the package inspection? Or make it vice versa. Any reason to use the package inspection in a public network? We are not talking about a darknet or something like that, a traffic that is going into a darknet. I'm looking into the traffic. Normally there's traffic that should not be there. That can be handled, that can be maybe done. Is there any reason why I should do the packet inspection in a public network?
Maybe because you also need to analyze the traffic to understand the communication protocol that the botnet is using. So if you really want to fight it, you also need to understand how the nodes in the botnet communicate. And you need to create some sort of sinkhole or something.
If I sinkhole it, that's the main difference. I'm not doing it on DKIX, on a very big network, and every traffic grabbing out. I'm doing it locally on a box I control. There's traffic coming to this specific box, and I'm looking into traffic that I receive there. That's a little bit different to a DKIX or a traffic on a peering point. Okay. No reason for deep packet inspection. So, why are we talking about the packet inspection? The German government, I have shown it on the slide here, the DNS changer EU asks us to use a similar technique to redirect the malicious DNS traffic to controlled DNS servers to not have the internet blackout on a given date. Does this make sense to you? On the one hand side, the German government is wanting to raise attention to infected machines, to infected customers. And on the other side, they took care, or the ISPs took care about with the redirection of DNS traffic. Wouldn't it be more wiser to let them go down, to not see the internet anymore, and to raise the attention with a broken internet?
I'm Peter Koch, Denik. I'm a bit confused, as usual. Could you elaborate on what the German government asked you to do and on what legal grounds they did?
Bon?
Could you elaborate on what exactly the German government asked you to do?
The German government and
what the legal grounds for that were?
The German, not the German government, this was the BSI, and it was something like, can we do something technically, something more technically, not have an internet blackout on a given date? It was asked by the BSI if there are technical possibilities to not lose the internet.
Does that answer your question, Peter?
Well, that leaves me to conclude that I'm not the only confused
person. We can do it. We can. If you like to, we can do it bilaterally.
So,
because I think it's English is not my mother language.
No, I guess that's not the that's not a problem of language or communication here. The point is, we're now going back to the whole DNS changer topic and how to prolong this this countermeasure, which, by the way, has interesting policy implications all over the place that I would like to dive into more rapidly than into the technical details, but that's probably not the right venue here. So then I understand they asked you in terms of, they really asked the question instead of ordering you to do something.
Yes.
That's the first
point.
It's
just a question.
So a real question, not in a question like, please do that, or would you please do that? Okay. Thanks for that clarification. And that's eliminates the needs for the legal grounds, because of course the government can ask questions all the time. How did you respond? So what is happening at D6 or in cooperation with BSI on the topic of DNS changer? Could you elaborate on that a bit?
What we have done then was receiving the data from the DNS changer working group and pushing out the data to the affected ISPs, proceeding notice and takedown, and not to look into traffic or to reroute something to a box that is controlled by the German government or by the ISP itself.
Jay. If I could ask a question about privacy again, at what depth into a packet does looking into a packet become illegal?
The IP address, for instance, is in Germany, is a private data.
Right.
The IP address in combination with a timestamp is a private data.
Okay.
If there is a domain name or, for instance, is in a communication, domain name is a private data.
The protocol field?
I'm not sure.
Okay. There is a researcher in New Zealand who has an alternative to deep packet inspection that looks at, I think, the first 4 bytes, that's all, and can tell you a great deal about what's going inside that using statistical analysis techniques rather than looking any further, and doesn't need to look at the IP address as part of that either, and the first 4 bytes of the payload. So if you're interested in that, that may provide you a way around some of those things, but you may not want a way around it.
I think in Germany we need to rename the stuff, because deep packet inspection in the term is clearly say we took a deep look into a package. Because if we are if we are doing something like that, then we need to use another term.
Okay.
just as we're on the subject, are those existing tools for the DPI IPv6 compatible? Because I'm thinking that many of the older ones aren't.
To the audience.
I'm more interested in what's possible. What is theoretically or practical possible if the legal framework was different or nobody would care about a legal framework?
What I have mentioned, if you have something like a private data involved, then it doesn't make sense in Germany, for instance, to do the packet inspection. A domain name by itself is a private data.
No, I mean the other way around. What could you do if you were allowed to, or if the legal framework was different? How far? What's technically possible these days?
You see everything. You have the possibility to see everything, the complete communication, if you have the possibility to put the packages afterwards.
Can the 2 terabytes a terabits a second? Can you analyze this?
No, that's impossible.
So,
with a
you would sample
with million? Yes, you maybe each one millionth data package or something like that. Maybe that's possible, but in this, with the volume we have at DKIX, it's impossible to proceed it.
Okay. All right. Any other questions?
Not in lifetime.
Yeah, but can you write it? Can you for example, copy the data onto servers? Yeah, it's not possible. No?
If I lose, then I lose a lot of time. If I write it down to a hard drive and analyze it afterwards, then I have written down 1 hour and I need to analyze, let's say, 4 hours, 5 hours.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? There is a remote question.
Hello. Yes. Mark Lampo wants to know, instead of deep packet inspection, why not flow-based analysis? Do you have agreements planned to have to obtain flow data from ISPs?
This is something the ISPs are doing, as far as I know, flow data.
Can you go a little bit more detail?
The flow data must exclude the IP addresses as well, so you only have the HTTP traffic, the HTTP headers in a very, very short way. You only see some... Yes, everything where is a private data involved is problematic in Germany. And if you are doing it let's say in a darknet area or something like that, then you can do that because there is no traffic that is valid or that should be valid.
All right, any more questions? Peter again.
Yeah, sorry for insisting on that. I think there are two issues mixed here. The one is the ability or not to do deep packet inspection at an internet exchange, which I wouldn't really see in Europe somewhere. The other one is dealing with the peculiarities of DNS changer, which actually doesn't really need deep packet inspection, but there are mitigation strategies available even to the ISP, and they have been had been available and wouldn't have needed all this policy sinfalls and everything so far. So what's probably going to happen is that at I don't know what date in early July, 7th, thanks, Jaap, when the centrally run name servers, or resolvers I should say, are to be turned off and maybe the announcement withdrawn, then this traffic directed to the well-known formerly malicious IP addresses, or sorry, I shouldn't say malicious IP addresses, but IP addresses of these rogue servers that had been taken down so long ago. So when these disappear, the traffic will probably still flow, but just sink. Did you talk to ISPs what they are going to do with this traffic? Would that fall into your mission here? And could you elaborate on that? Like setting up their own version of the server or doing something completely different?
No, they will not do that. They will let the customers call into their support lines in Germany and guide them to fix the DNS server on their own by using tools or whatever. So nothing will be set up from the ISPs I have talked to. And I know from at least Vodafone and Deutsche Telekom that they will not set up something like that.
I just want to, if somebody noticed that was the information that before USA, whatever, Homeland Security discovered a lot of botnet and like dark net of internet, they actually run the this kind of alternative DNS services for around 9 months. So this is indeed reason. If you redirect traffic to different and create something where you can observe the activity, this is what I read. So this is what can be also explained what how it can use for what purpose.
Anything else? All right. Thank you very much. It was a little bit shorter than I expected, but if it's interactive and there isn't much coming from the public, there's not much we can do about it. But in any case, thank you very much. Unfortunately, yes. In particular, I appreciate that you came out on relatively short notice and on your company's own expense. And I wanted to mention that. And next time I see Mr. Rotert, I will tell him again how much I appreciate it. All right, the next thing would be a rather pleasant thing, at least for me, not for Antoine or so. Because the Dutch registry is sponsoring lunch, so we usually give a few minutes time for a word from our sponsors, in particular when the sponsor is non-profit.
Have a few words. I'll fill in the gap then. First of all, I'm very pleased to be here again. SIDN has been one of the first CCNSO members, and I remember I also visited the first CCNSO Tech Day, which I think was back in Puerto Rico. Or was it before that?
LA
or Puerto Rico, anyway. Few words about SIDN, of course. I won't be in the way between you and lunch. SIDN runs the .NL registry and also some small enum zone. As of this morning, we have 5,982,256 delegations, which means we will be running over 5 million very soon. Since 15th of May, we have DNSSEC in production, and we now have 2,176 DNSSEC signed delegations. We just announced a two-year incentive for the DNSSEC deployment, which will probably mean that we're hoping to have 200,000 DNSSEC delegation by the end of this year. And it's targeted at registrars. So registrars, and we have a lot of large registrars that already have signed into the incentive. So I think it will give a boost to DNSSEC deployment, at least in the Netherlands, but we hope it will be outside the Netherlands as well. I have something new to tell you that I know that for DNSSEC deployment there has been some discussions about secure transfers of domain names. Well, I can... we just performed some tests, or not really tests, in our real production system. We have just performed secure DNSSEC transfers. So we know it can work. I will have a blog on this later this week, and probably for all of you who want to talk about it later for lunch, There's a great opportunity, of course. I'll give you some topics to discuss for lunch, of course. SADNF has recently increased their DNS research and development. We have formed an SIDN Labs, like most registries are now going into some more research and development. We have just done the same. We have done increased cooperation with NLNet Labs, but that's not the only outreach that we are doing. We're also sponsoring the Bind10 project. We also have sponsored PowerDNSSEC. And in that context, the discussion of this afternoon, where we will be sort of like discussing multiple vendors or multiple DNS implementation, is one of our interesting topics. We are setting up at this moment a DNS workbench where we will run and test all this DNS software, and we will report on it and even give others the opportunity to make use of this DNS R&D program if they want to do tests on name server software they don't run themselves. SADN has been an independent contributor to the internet development, and we want to continue to do so. And that's why we want to sponsor the CCNSO Tech Day, because we believe in sharing knowledge. And I think the CCNSO Tech Day is a wonderful opportunity to do that. So without further ado, I want you to enjoy your lunch and have nice topics to discuss.
Where's the applause? I think the biggest applause came from the ZZNIC, because I had them online to sponsor lunch if we hadn't found a sponsor. So we had, as we say in Namibia, we had a cunning plan. Anyway, thank you very much, everybody who presented so far. We will meet exactly at 2 o'clock. We will not even wait a second, because we are going a little bit early now. We will start with the host presentation. Andre will tell us about what they're doing, and especially what they're doing on DNSSEC. I like the word incentive about DNSSEC. Does that mean you give your registrars who do DNSSEC a discount, Antoine? Are you giving your registrars who do DNSSEC a discount as an incentive, or how do you do that?
Yes. We're giving on the wholesale price, they will get a discount. And it's also it's a longer incentive, so it's going to be 2 years. I don't know if there's a threshold. Do you know?
No, there's
no threshold.
Okay. No, I'm thinking about the same thing. As you may know, Namibia has got 2,500 names, of which 7 are DNSSEC signed, and we are also thinking of pushing this by telling our registrars that they get the discount, so that they have to start not only signing it, but they also have to install resolvers that can resolve this, because there is not a single resolver in Namibia that can resolve. When we do this, we all have to use the OAC and these ethnic ones and so on.
That's, of course, a next step.
All right, thank you very much for your attendance. We'll see each other exactly at 2 o'clock. The lunch will arrive at exactly 1 o'clock, at least that's what the plan is. So we must be patient a little bit, hang around, talk, communicate, whatever.